This is Diane Horn, your host on the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and online at kexp.org. Our guest this morning is architect Edward Masria, a senior principal at Masria, Inc., an architecture and design firm in Santa Fe, New Mexico, and founder of Architecture 2030, a nonprofit whose mission is to rapidly transform the U.S. and global building sector from the major contributor of greenhouse gas emissions to a central part of the solution to the global warming crisis. Edward is author of the Passive Solar Energy book, senior analyst for the Southwest Climate Council, and adjunct professor at the University of New Mexico. He speaks nationally and internationally on the subject of climate change and architecture. Edward Masria is here today to tell us about the 2030 challenge to achieve a dramatic reduction in the greenhouse gas emission of buildings by changing the way they are designed and constructed. Welcome.
Nice to be here.
It's great to have you. What led you to found Architecture 2030?
Well, back around 2002, we conducted some research on greenhouse gas emissions, on global warming, and just sort of by accident, in a way, wanted to see what our contribution was as an office and as a profession. And when we got into it and started producing the numbers and creating a building sector, there actually wasn't one at that time. We created a building sector, took the same numbers and just redistributed them into a building sector. Everything that we do as architects and designers in the construction and design industries, we found out that we were really the major part of the problem and figured at that time that we were the major part of the solution. So that's kind of how we got started.
Could you elaborate on what you include in the term building sector?
Yeah, the building sector right now is about 48% of total annual U.S. energy consumption. That's all across the board. And it's made up of about 40% of total U.S. energy consumption is just building operations. That's heating, lighting, cooling, and hot water, the big four, and then running equipment and computers and things like that, which are, again, add into it, but are a smaller part. And then 8% of total U.S. energy consumption is the actual manufacture and transportation of the materials and building the building itself. So that gets us to 48%. If we look at just greenhouse gas emissions in the building sector, we find that 43% of all greenhouse gas emissions are attributed just to the building operations. So total greenhouse gas emissions in the building sector is somewhere around 50%.
Now, the numbers you've just given are for the United States, is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct. Globally, it's probably similar, but maybe even a little more, because globally you have both the transportation and industrial sector that are probably a lot less, and the building sectors are probably a lot larger in many underdeveloped countries, for example. We ran some numbers globally and found that it was very, very close, very similar, but a little more. The building sector was just slightly over 50%.
What level of reduction in greenhouse gas emissions is needed for the building sector to do its part in preventing catastrophic climate change?
Well, right now the building sector is increasing at about 1.5%, 2% a year in terms of its emissions, so it's a little bit larger, actually, than the other two sectors, which are industry and transportation. Actually, industry is the one that's not increasing very much. Transportation is increasing along with the building sector. Just to level out the building sector, you would have to stop any demand, for example, in building energy consumption in this country. But we know we add more buildings every year, and so consumption keeps going up. So the first thing we want to do is level it out so that we're not increasing our consumption in the building sector. And then we want to reduce consumption basically annually out to about 60, maybe 70, 80% of today's level by about 2050. So that's a pretty dramatic drop. Every sector really needs to do that. So if we want to do our part as a sector, we need to be between 40 and 60% below 1990 levels, which are basically 60 to 80% below today's levels.
Could you go into more detail about the 2030 challenge and say what's being proposed for new buildings and then what's being proposed for old buildings that may need to be renovated as well?
Right. About a year ago, well, before that, we figured what will it take to just stabilize emissions and energy consumption in the building sector. That means that it wouldn't be climbing at 1.5% a year or 2% a year. And the way to do that is that with all buildings that you renovate, you reduce their consumption through renovating the buildings. So what we're asking for in the 2030 challenge, there are actually three parts. So in the first part, what we're saying is that all renovations, major renovations, reduce that building's energy consumption and greenhouse gas emissions by half the regional average for that building type. So if you're a school, it would be, and you're renovating that school, you would reduce the consumption to about half the average of the schools in that area, in that region. Or if you're doing a residence, it would be the same thing. And what that does then is it actually reduces consumption in your area, because now you're renovating buildings and you're reducing their consumption. That makes room for new buildings to come in, and we're asking that all new buildings meet an energy consumption and greenhouse gas emissions performance standard of half the regional average for that building type. And we're also asking that you renovate as many buildings as you build new in your area. So the 50-50 there, 50 renovation down and then coming in at 50% below the regional average for new buildings, that would then level the building sector in that area out, so you would not have any increasing emissions or increasing consumption. And then we say that every 5 years, you actually reduce the consumption by an additional 10%. So, for example, in 2010, actually, we started this in 2005, 2006. In 2010, you'd need a 60% reduction for all new buildings, 50% always for renovation. So you're always renovating because you have an existing building to half the regional average. But new buildings, you reduce by 10% again every 5 years, so that by 2010, it's 70% reduction. 2015, it's an 80% reduction, so that by the time you get to 2030, all new buildings would be designed what we would call carbon neutral, meaning they would use no greenhouse gas-emitting fossil fuel energy to operate. That doesn't mean they don't use energy, but they don't use greenhouse gas-emitting energy to operate. And that's the challenge, the 2030 challenge.
How easy or difficult is it to design and build a building that is carbon neutral?
Carbon neutral gets somewhat tough today. It's not just a matter of design. We know, for example, that we can design out quite a bit of energy consumption in a building just through simple strategies like where you locate the building, how you orient the building, which side of the building you put the windows on, whether you shade them or not, whether you use passive solar heating and cooling strategies or daylighting strategies, whether you use natural ventilation. There are all sorts of efficient lighting systems. There are many, many, many cost-effective, what we call low-tech, which would be either no cost, cost savings, or minimal cost options for reducing consumption. So we think that you can get anywhere to between 30 and 70% reduction just through these kinds of design strategies in terms of building energy consumption. But to get to carbon neutral, then, you have to then get that other 30% out or 40% or whatever it is, and that's going to take some money. So in that sense, you would use what we call technology. You would add technology, and that would be more of a high-tech addition. So you would, for example, add solar hot water heating for domestic hot water heating needs. You might add photovoltaics for electricity needs. You might add small-scale wind power. Or we say, try to reduce your consumption as much as you can through the low-tech, no-cost, low-cost options or cost savings options, and then make up the difference either by adding technology or by purchasing clean power so that you really do have a carbon neutral building.
What is the upfront cost likely to be of a carbon neutral building compared to most buildings that are built, and also compared to the energy efficient buildings that can be built with the more low-tech conventional techniques?
Yeah, I think that's a tough question to answer because there is no standard answer, and I'll give you an example. I get that question quite a bit. Let's say we take 100 architects and we have a site and we want to build an office building on that site. It could be a residence, could be whatever, but let's just say an office building. And we give each of those 100 architects the same exact site, the same program, same square footage, same budget, and we say go design the most efficient building you can do within that cost. You will get a few architects that are talented enough with their engineers and landscape architects that'll get you to carbon neutral at no additional cost. And you'll get all the way down to the other end of the spectrum that it will cost a fortune. So it really depends on the talent and the education level of the people you hire. Now, that being said, we know, for example, that maybe 1.5%, 2% additional cost in housing, you can get a 50 to 30% reduction, get to an ENERGY STAR building. So to get to 50%, a 50% reduction, on average, you might be looking at 3 or 4%, something like that. To get to carbon neutral, it really depends on how much you can get out of the building through efficiency measures and then use add-on technology for the rest. Or you can buy, for example, you can go to carbon neutral now if you have a fairly efficient building and you buy clean power at maybe half a cent a kilowatt more or something like that. So it doesn't have to cost very much. So there are lots of different ways. And now we have tremendous incentives that are being put into place to, for example, purchase photovoltaic systems or solar hot water systems, both at the state level. And we're looking, hopefully, to extending the Energy Policy Act and increasing the incentives in that act for a lot of the measures so that the costs for going to anywhere between 50% and carbon neutral are really not very much.
I'm Diane Horn, and we are speaking with architect Edward Masria, founder of Architecture 2030. Our topic is the 2030 challenge to achieve a dramatic reduction in the greenhouse gas emissions of buildings by changing the way they are designed and constructed. You've been alluding to this already, but how feasible is it to meet the goals of the 2030 challenge? Is it practical?
Oh, I think it's not only practical, but it's necessary. It must be done. I don't think we have a choice. When people talk about it, they look at present day and they say, well, today, how much is it going to cost me, you know, if I want to do this right now? And they're not looking at life cycle costs. For example, how much am I saving on my energy costs? Those are going to invariably go up. If we go to a cap and trade system and putting a price on carbon and all sorts of other things, price of energy is going to go up. So conservation makes tremendous sense. And if you project it out, you could spend a lot more upfront dollars now, pay it out over time, and be basically at the same level in terms of your outlay, for example, in a residence, because you're saving that amount of money on your energy costs. And those costs are going up. And your savings then become greater as you go out in time. We're not used to thinking that way. We're used to thinking of how much is it costing me right now. But I'm just running right now. Actually, I'll be in your area for a lecture in the near future, and I'll be in Boston and in Atlanta, and I'm just running now what a 1 meter sea level rise will mean along the East Coast and the Gulf, and I'll get to the West Coast pretty soon because I'll be out there. A 1 meter rise, the IPCC, the UN Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which just came out with its summary and is coming out with a more detailed report, basically says that we could have up to a 2 foot rise in sea level by 2100. That's kind of their upper level. But then they have a caveat in there that says that's without any melt from the two polar ice caps, from Greenland and Antarctica. Well, scientists at NASA are saying they're beginning to melt. They're shrinking, actually, in size over the past 5 years. And that's a danger sign. And they could easily add each one a half a meter just by themselves in a very, very short period of time. So we took a look at a 3 foot or 1 meter sea level rise along the East Coast. Miami Beach would be gone. Fort Lauderdale would be basically inundated and gone. Wildwood, New Jersey would be gone. Langley Air Force Base would be gone. Hampton, Virginia would be gone. You look at those kinds of things and New Orleans, not only New Orleans, but the whole area down in that area, all the little townships along the river there, that would all be gone too. You're looking at an astronomical cost. So the cost of not doing anything could basically devastate this country in a very, very short period of time. So when we talk about costs and we talk about, well, what is it going to cost us and maybe it's not feasible, I don't think, personally, in terms of the risk, I don't think we have a choice. We took a chance, for example, with not putting in $1 to $2 billion to fix the levees in New Orleans. Everyone knew the scenario was laid out very, very clearly by many, many people, including in articles that one read on what exactly would happen in New Orleans if a hurricane hit. and it would have taken about $1 billion or $2 billion to have fixed that situation, and we decided to take a risk and not invest that kind of money because we thought it was too much. It's now costing us $200 to $300 billion to put that city back together, if we can even do that. And we've shattered a huge number of lives and lives lost by rolling the dice and saying we're going to take the risk. Well, the risk that we're talking about now is a lot greater, so I don't think we can afford to take that risk.
How effective has the LEEDS rating system been so far, and to what extent can it contribute to meeting the 2030 challenge?
Well, LEED is a great start. The U.S. Green Building Council, I think, has done a great job by implementing a standard, because then you can look at it and say, okay, this is the standard, now how can we go beyond that standard? Well, up until Green Build, which was the last U.S. Green Building Council conference in Denver a few months ago, 3 or 4 months ago, there was no actual baseline, for example, established for energy consumption and greenhouse gas emissions. We made a presentation to the U.S. Green Building Council at Green Build, and right there they adopted the 2030 challenge target as the baseline now for LEED certification. And they're in the process of putting that in for just basic LEED certification. Then you can go beyond that as you go out in time. So I think the U.S. Green Building Council and LEED certification are changing as we speak. And so I think it will also establish a minimum baseline. But what we need and what the U.S. Green Building Council, I think, wants to do is to go beyond the 2030 challenge so that we do have buildings that are out in front of the challenge, so that we have examples as we move out in time toward 2030 to carbon neutral, that we have lots of examples of buildings that are being built helping us see how to do this as we move out in time. So the U.S. Green Building Council is very important. The American Institute of Architects has also adopted it. The U.S. Conference of Mayors has adopted the challenge. And I think Jim Hansen, one of our top climate scientists, just called for Congress to adopt the 2030 challenge also in a talk he gave on Monday in D.C. So I think we're beginning to see some movement around the country toward meeting these goals. And the point is that there are many, many, many ways to meet it. There's not just one way to meet it. So, you know, if you can't do it through design or you can't do it through adding technology, you can do it with community energy systems, and if you can't do it that way, you can buy clean power. So there are just so many options to meet the targets that they're very doable.
Is there an effort being made to encourage the design and construction of smaller buildings, since a smaller size generally means less greenhouse gas emissions for a building?
Absolutely. Obviously, the smaller the size, the less consumption, the less area you have to heat and cool, the less area you have to light. Your actual footprint, the smaller it becomes. For example, we find that as you increase the density of an area, for example, as you go to higher density in towns and in cities, the actual amount of space that people rent and use becomes less and less. So if you're out in the country, you're likely to live in a home that's about twice the size of a person in an urban area, fairly dense urban area. So actually, how we plan our cities and how we do infill and begin increasing our density up to a point, I don't think we know yet at what point the savings begin to reverse themselves because of increased infrastructure costs and just more infrastructure. I think that needs to be looked into. But in general, increasing density really decreases a person's need for space.
What is most needed for the 2030 challenge to be met? How will we get there?
I think there are two things that are key to this happening. One is about half the way there, and that is that the U.S. Conference of Mayors adopted the 2030 challenge unanimously about 7 or 8 months ago. So that was half the battle. The other half is now implementing it at the city level. So every city now needs to then implement the targets and figure out a way to do that. It will be a lot easier for the cities to do it if the federal government helps. So what we're asking for, and we think, for example, Tom Udall is working on legislation now to introduce legislation into Congress to basically extend the Energy Policy Act. The Energy Policy Act will give you, for example, in commercial buildings, $1.80 a square foot if you meet a 50% reduction in energy consumption, a reduction below a certain baseline, which they have as ASHRAE 90.1. What we would, and they'll give you $2,000 a unit, for example. Well, in many cases, just the paperwork and the accounting and everything that you have to do to get these credits offsets the amount of money that you would get. So a lot of people are not taking advantage of it. We think that if we can pretty much double the credits, if we can get Congress to double the credits, extend the Energy Policy Act 5 years, for example, go from $1.80 to $2.75 a square foot for commercial buildings, from $2,000 to $4,500 a unit for residential building construction, for example, if you meet the 50% target, to go from $500 tax credit per individual for non-business to about $1,000, and to take away the cap. They now have a $2,000 cap on solar, hot water, and photovoltaic for residences, to have an unlimited cap with a 30% tax credit. If the feds would do that, that would be a tremendous incentive for the cities then to implement the 2030 challenge targets, because now someone can go in and offset quite a bit of the cost, the additional costs, on average, that it would cost them to do these things. And so then I think they would have a much, much easier time implementing the targets. So with just a little bit of help from the federal government, I think the states and cities will move very, very quickly.
What is being done to train new architects to design carbon neutral buildings?
Well, about a year ago, a study was released by the American Institute of Architects Committee on the Environment. It was called Ecology and Design. It was not a very flattering report on design education and ecology, for example, ecological literacy and education, design education, especially in architecture. It was done mostly for architecture schools, but I think it applied across the board, everything from industrial design to the planning, for example. Since that time, though, there's been tremendous movement, I think, over the past year. And then a week and a half ago, we conducted what was called the 2010 Imperative, which was a live webcast. We held a live discussion and almost a symposium in New York City and webcast it live to about 250,000 people logged on to hear the webcast. And we dealt with the science behind climate change. James Hansen talked about the science. We also talked about the connection between the building sector and education and what education must do in order to train architects and designers across the board to operate in this new kind of environment that we're beginning to change into. And so we called on all schools to basically adopt what we issued was another challenge called the 2010 Imperative, and it was specifically for design schools. And what it said, it had three parts to it, and we issued it at the 2010 Imperative, this global emergency teach-in that was webcast, and many, many schools canceled classes that day and held events around the teach-in. And what we asked for was three things. One is that in all problems that instructors give to students in studio, in design studio, that their problem, that their solution, basically their design, meet an energy consumption, engage the environment in a way that basically reduces or eliminates the need for fossil fuels. So we'd like that one sentence added to all design problems, not for instructors to change the problem, but to just add that the students be aware and design to basically a carbon neutral standard. And then we ask that the schools develop within their program complete ecological literacy by 2010. That's why it was the 2010 imperative. So that when students are drawing things on paper and designing things, the way architects and industrial designers and other designers do, planners, we draw things on paper, students need to know what the implications of those drawings are. Where does the material come from? Who makes it? What kind of resources are they offsetting? Are they destroying plant and animal species by specifying these things or drawing these kinds of things? So we want complete ecological literacy, or we're asking for that, by 2010. And we're asking that the design schools themselves within the campuses, their actual school buildings become carbon neutral by 2010, so that the students are working in buildings that are carbon neutral as they're being taught to design carbon neutral buildings and products and master plans. So that was the 2010 imperative, and the numbers are now coming in. We reached about 250,000 people.
What kind of response have you gotten from the architectural schools?
It has been phenomenal. We did no advertising, for example. It was all through the Internet. And to have 250,000 people log on, and universities like the University of Michigan School of Architecture cancel classes for the day, and the whole school watched the teaching and then had discussions afterwards. Same thing with Cal Poly San Luis Obispo and Minnesota, University of Minnesota, University of Washington and St. Louis, I think Pratt Institute in New York, I think Parsons, Columbia had a big discussion, watched the teaching, had a big discussion afterwards, Columbia University, just across the board. We had Milwaukee, for example, cancel classes, had 800 people in a big auditorium watching the teaching and then discussing it afterwards. Cal Poly Pomona, I think, the same. So we had schools all across the U.S. I think we had almost all the schools. There might have been a few holdouts, but pretty much most of the architecture and design schools around the country watched and engaged and participated in the teaching.
Well, what's the message you'd like to leave our listeners with?
Well, it's a message of action and hope. What the scientists do is they can project, and they tell us, they give us projections of what the future holds, or what at least what their analysis of the future holds if we don't take action. It's pretty bleak, from species extinction. I think NASA's saying business as usual. 50% of all species on Earth would be gone by 2100. I mean, these are not pretty pictures, and sea level rise and all that. But the good news to take away from this is that they're making the predictions, and we know how to avert that kind of situation, and as long as we take action. So it's not like we're going into this thing blind and then all of a sudden we're going to be hit over the head with this thing and there's nothing we can do. We have time to take action, and the time to take action is now, and we know what the risks are, and all we have to do is act. If we act, we don't go to where the scientists are telling us we're headed, as long as we change direction. And so the science gives us a tremendous advantage in order to avert all sorts of situations that I don't think we want to get into. So I tell students and other folks that it's an incredibly exciting time, because we really have a chance to change the course of the direction we seem to be going, and actually change the course of history in a sense. So it's a very exciting time, I think, to be here.
Well, thanks so much for being here.
Okay. Well, thanks for having me.
We have just been speaking with architect Edward Masria, founder of Architecture 2030. For more information, check on the web at www.architecture2030.org. Again, that's architecture2030.org. The sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters program you have just heard will be on the streaming archive section of KEXP's website at kexp.org for the next 14 days. In addition, selected sustainability segment interviews are available as podcasts. Go to kexp.org, click on podcasting, and scroll down to Mind Over Matters sustainability segment. I'm Diane Horn. Thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in to the sustainability segment again next week.